Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Paul Riesmandel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jennifer Waits.
And I'm Eric Klein.
And today we're going to talk about the fairness doctrine, because it's back on the lips of many commentators, on the tips of their pens, in their, coming out in the press. And so we've invited our friend, Professor Christopher Terry from the University of Minnesota, once again, to help us, remind everyone what this is and what it isn't, because that's often at the root of a lot of this. And, you know, talk a little bit about why we're talking about it again and help us kind of dig into that history a little bit. To really build out that story, right? To help folks really understand this cudgel that seems to be lashed around quite a bit.
The cudgel you're referencing, Paul, is one of the oldest pieces of media regulation in the country. After the First Amendment.
Then well, comes, that's sort of putting it sort of.
Then comes the fairness doctrine.
Welcome, Chris. Thanks for being with us.
It's always great to be here, and I'm glad that we've oversimplified the fairness doctrine before we even get started today.
You have to keep it simple in the first minute, and then you can complicate it during the next.
Okay, that's sure. Right. Here's a simple version of the fairness doctrine. The myths about the fairness doctrine are equivalent to the myths about shouting fire in a crowded theater, both of which are just highly misunderstood First Amendment standards and practices as it goes. The fairness doctrine is back, though. I haven't gone more than a couple days in a row for several weeks now without at least one person, a reporter, somebody online, like formally reaching out to ask me about the fairness doctrine. It's actually become an insanely common topic for me to be talking about. And there's two reasons for that. The reason it's back is, number one, there's a lot of effort in our society, good and bad, to try to do something to balance media in some way. The most notable which is to do something about web platforms that get rid of certain speakers for certain reasons. There's a lot of effort in Congress. There's a lot of effort at the state level. Both Texas and Florida have passed rules that are functionally online fairness doctrines in many ways. So there's a lot of interest in that. But there's also a lot of interest in trying to do something about media organizations that people disagree with, that they believe that if the fairness doctrine were to come back, it would balance out things like Fox News. And of course, even if the fairness doctrine were still around, and it's been gone for a very, very long time, none of that is true, right? The fairness doctrine didn't do a lot of the things that people assume it did. And if I had a dollar for everyone who's yelled at me in social media about how I don't know about what the fairness doctrine did, I'd have a lot of dollars. Let's put it that way.
Can you rewind then, Chris, and tell us what is the fairness doctrine? Wait,
but can I make it worse? Can I say what the
sure,
fairness doctrine myth is? Because that I understand.
Oh yeah.
And that's what most people think it is, probably. It's that if Fox News has a Republican on to talk about why spending $4 trillion on Biden's agenda is a waste, they need to have Bernie Sanders on to say why spending $4 trillion on Americans is the only way to save the country for the future. They have to balance it. They're required to balance every topic.
Well, the most common myth of the fairness doctrine is actually the idea of equal time. The original fairness doctrine didn't have anything to do with equal time. In fact, equal time is an entirely separate provision in FCC code. Actually, equal time is still on the books, but it only applies to political advertising. It is actually from the Communications Act of 1934, so it fits into that window Eric said between the First Amendment and when the Fairness Doctrine was actually created. It's actually from 1934, but large portions of the equal time rule still apply, but they only apply to broadcasters. So over-the-air broadcast radio, over-the-air broadcast television.
Not the
and internet. Only in the context of political advertising run in a 45 or 60-day window before an election.
And
that's
is that,
it.
So for broadcasters, does that not include cable then?
No. Cable is not bound by the same rules. Now, this goes to something that we've talked about on this show when I've been on in the past, is that radio and television are functionally different under the law because they use spectrum to broadcast from a position point through a licensed broadcaster. That means that their First Amendment protection is substantially curtailed, not because the government tends to regulate the things that they say or have to say, but because they took a license from the government in the first place. And that's a fundamentally unique situation when it comes to speech in U.S. history. Now, even the equal time rule has been gutted. The very famous case of Howard Stern earned himself an equal time complaint, and the FCC then applied the what is known as the bona fide news exception rule, that those equal time provisions don't apply if a political candidate appears in the context of a news or informational style programming.
So just to draw that out, what that means, sure. Chris, right, is that if a candidate appears on the Tonight Show,
if Donald Trump is on the Tonight Show,
and that's entertainment or Saturday Night Live, that's considered different than if the candidate appears on the NBC Nightly News or even a local news program.
In fact, one of the very rare that's actually a great example. One of the very rare times where equal time has actually applied to anything besides political advertising in my lifetime, actually, is that when Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump each appeared on Saturday Night Live, there were already primary races going on. So that puts those situations inside of the political window. And how they handled the equal time complaints from the other candidates that were in the races, both on the Republican side, although far less on the Democratic side, just because it was basically those two, Bernie and Hillary, is they just gave them some free ads. Mm-hmm. Right. That was just how they handled it. And only for that Saturday night. But that's equal time. The Fairness Doctrine is something entirely different, even though I can show you unbelievable amounts of literature that is written about the Fairness Doctrine saying equal time. Fairness Doctrine never required equal time. But to understand the Fairness Doctrine, you really need to understand where it came from. Fairness Doctrine is the end game on a series of events that starts in the 1930s. In 1939, the FCC made a very obscure ruling called the Mayflower Decision. The Mayflower Decision became known as the Mayflower Doctrine. But like many of the FCC's doctrines, it actually only applied to one set of facts in one case. What happened in that case was there were two people competing for one broadcast license in the city of Boston. One person in Boston actually, through sort of a weird series of events, controlled both of the AM radio stations that were on the air in Boston in 1938. And a competing company made a bid for one of the two licenses, and they were known as Yankee. And what they did was they said, the guy who owns these two stations is using them to editorialize on behalf of candidates that he likes. Specifically, their beef was about the mayoral race and one state assembly race at the time. The FCC drug its feet on this comparative license hearing for a long time. And remember, this is back when stations had to renew their license basically every year. And eventually they give the license back to the person who had it, but they come out with the Mayflower Doctrine, and they say that broadcast stations can carry news, but they can't editorialize. They can't carry opinion discussions. And of course, the broadcasters went berserk at the idea that this is what had happened. Now, there's a lot of discussion historically about whether or not the FCC meant what they said in the Mayflower Decision, or whether people read a little bit more into what was being said in the Mayflower Decision than what the FCC meant to say. Regardless of which, broadcasters looked at the Mayflower Decision at the end of 1939, and they said, we're not allowed to editorialize. And they went crazy. And Justin Miller, who was head of the NAB at the time, and James Lawrence Fly, who was head of the FCC at the time, two very dynamic figures who were sort of in conflict. They're sort of going to war with each other. But then World War II happens, and the issue gets punted down the road a little bit. But during the war, the broadcasters go to the FCC and they say, look, if we can't editorialize, we need to know what it takes to serve the public interests in these areas. And right after the war, the FCC comes out with something called the Blue Book. It's a federal document that came in a blue covered folder. And there's one at the Wisconsin Memorial Society Archives. One of the original Blue Books is still there. Victor Picard wrote extensively about the Blue Book and some of his scholarship. But the long story short was, is that the Blue Book was sort of a set of guidelines given from the FCC to broadcasters to answer the questions not only about what had happened in the Mayflower case, but also to say what it would take to actually do that really basic thing that your license required to serve the public interest. But one of the things that the FCC said in the Blue Book is that you should limit the amount of advertising you carry in an hour. Now, there were other things that the broadcasters objected to. No, that's what they really objected to. They were really, the broadcasters really didn't like this idea at all. And the limits on the advertising were fairly narrow. I don't remember exactly what they were offhand, but they were, it was a dramatic reduction in the amount of advertising they're allowed to carry. So the war that had been brewing between the broadcasters and the FCC since the Mayflower Doctrine gets carried into the Blue Book. They broadcasters immediately revolt against these new standards in the Blue Book. They go back to the FCC and they say, try again. And then in 1949, the FCC says, okay, we're going to tell you what it takes to meet this obligation to serve the public interest. And that's where they come up with the Fairness Doctrine. And in 1949, they released the first version of the Fairness Doctrine. Now, I don't want to go too far off the rails here, but this is what the Fairness Doctrine required of a licensee. That a licensee cover issues of public interest to a local audience, and that when those issues were controversial, that the opportunity be provided for more than one viewpoint on that. Now, that didn't mean Democrat and Republican, right and left, green spaghetti monster, or purple spaghetti monster. What it meant was is that if there was an issue in which there was a debate, that the station should try to foster some discussion of that. The station retained the right to say who got to speak for how long, and most importantly, when. Right, it wasn't some sort of equal time provision, and it only applied in issues that there was some debate on. What the Fairness Doctrine was designed to do was give the broadcasters an obligation to cover issues in their local community. That's what its intent was, with the idea that if it's an ongoing debate, to allow more than one point of view. But that's all the Fairness Doctrine ever required of broadcasters, was cover issues of local concern, potentially allow for more than one viewpoint on that. That's it.
You know, when I was a child growing up, I'm now going to date myself a little bit, but in the 70s and 80s, I recall that local television affiliates that had local news often set aside, you know, a two-minute window, you know, before or after the news, to air an editorial, right? And so sometimes the editorial was presented by the general manager of the station or, you know, an employee there. And then it would say, you know, and we welcome replies from members of the public. And sometimes you would then therefore see, you know, maybe somebody who is a somewhat more prominent citizen, somebody, you know, a business person, public figure, but other times, not always, sometimes it was a more, you know, sort of average everyday citizen given an opportunity to respond to that. And as I interpret, that's sort of the Fairness Doctrine.
I have to mention that this has been passed down culturally, like the one place where young people might still see remnants of this moment where random citizens got a chance to say their piece at the news desk. That's where the first Weekend Update guest spots, Roseanne Rosanna Dana, was satirizing that character, and now any comedian who gets to sit down at the desk of Weekend Update is sort of echoing that from the past.
On Saturday Night Live, even if perhaps those comedians now have never actually witnessed the original impetus for that skit.
It was already hokey in the mid-70s, clearly.
The point that you refer to was still considered an important part of public service. It was part and parcel of what the Fairness Doctrine did, but it was entirely separate. Stations had, as licensees, they had the sort of authority to determine who got to speak and on what issues. Now, what happens to the Fairness Doctrine after 1949 is a more complicated story. The Fairness Doctrine is on the books, and the FCC enforces it in many of the ways that the FCC tends to enforce things, which is basically not to enforce them. Again, the Fairness Doctrine, like the Mayflower Doctrine before it, was sort of supposed to be sort of a guideline principle rather than an enforceable regulation.
Right, and the FCC often is more complaint-driven or driven by times of which, you know, like a license renewal, when they may review the record on a station's adherence to standards, etc., but that there's not FCC staff watching every minute of television, logging down, you know, moments in which all the viewpoints or the enough viewpoints were covered, right?
And that's exactly how it worked. In the mid-1950s, though, Congress was sort of asked to say whether or not the FCC had the authority to actually enforce the doctrine. And there's a lot of debate about what happens in 1954 on the Fairness Doctrine. The short version, the sort of too long, don't read version of this discussion is that Congress sort of codified the Fairness Doctrine as law. But the next really big moment for the Fairness Doctrine happens in 1967. The Fairness Doctrine is still the Fairness Doctrine, but it is expanded to include two additional rules. And this is where most people kind of lose what the Fairness Doctrine was about. In 1967, two rules were added to the Fairness Doctrine. The first was the political editorial rule. Political editorial rule worked very much like Equal Time did under Section 315, in that if a candidate for office was given a chance to editorialize on a subject, the opposing candidate in that race had to be notified that that was going to happen, and if they wanted to, they had to be provided a copy of that. It did not require that they were given equal time for a response, but if they wanted time to respond, they may have been given a portion of time to do that. Not an equivalent time, not equal time, not same time, just an opportunity there. Very few people actually ever used the political editorial rule in effect. The one that gets more attention, though, is the other corollary rule added to the Fairness Doctrine in 1967, and that is the personal attack rule. Personal attack rule said if you made a criticism about someone's name, likeness, or character, you had to provide them a copy of that, a notification that that had occurred, as well as provide an opportunity for a response. Of course, these are wholly compelled speech issues. Now the FCC isn't just saying, you know, you have an obligation to cover public issues. They're giving specific situations where you actually have to provide some mechanism to foster this debate. What ends up happening is that a Christian radio station, a very conservative Christian radio station, criticizes an author and on his show. And the author demands an opportunity to respond under the personal attack rule. The station agrees to give him the opportunity to respond, but they want $5 for the right to do that. Now, there's a lot of debate about where the $5 comes in or whatever, but the author in this case, he chooses not to pay the $5 and complains to the FCC. And the broadcasters get the case that they have wanted since 1949 to challenge both the Fairness Doctrine, but also these rules that were passed in 1967. That case goes to the U.S. Supreme Court under the name that is associated with the Fairness Doctrine, Red Lion Broadcaster versus FCC. In that case, the issue is, for the Supreme Court, whether or not the FCC has the authority to compel stations to allow this access. The broadcasters saw this case as sort of a slam dunk that the FCC didn't have this authority. But the decision is 8-0 for the FCC and the Fairness Doctrine. And what happens is that the Red Lion decision, like shouting fire in a theater and the Schenck decision that that comes from, and of course, in the Schenck decision, it's falsely shouting fire in a theater. We always forget the falsely part in that equation. What happens with Red Lion and the decision of Red Lion is that the Supreme Court says, well, broadcasters are in this kind of unique situation, right? That they have a license to speak to the exception of others. And what really matters is not whether or not the broadcaster gets to speak, but what the listener gets to hear. And the FCC sort of turns First Amendment doctrine on its head a little bit in Red Lion, saying what really matters is not whether or not a broadcaster gets to speak or whether or not a broadcaster is forced to do something it doesn't want to do. It matters what content the listeners have. They call it the rights of the listener.
And again, this is in 1969.
69. Big year for First Amendment cases. Brandenburg versus Ohio is that year. That's the incitement case. Tinker v. Des Moines is the student media or student speech case, right? Also Red Lion that year. Big year for First Amendment decisions. But the court is really focused on what broadcasting is supposed to do. Broadcasting is supposed to carry a message out to the listeners and the viewers. And they say that's why this is okay. Spectrum scarcity makes the government's ability to make people say things that they wouldn't otherwise say. Okay.
By spectrum scarcity, we mean not
electromagnetic.
Everybody can have a radio license. That there's only so many licenses for radio, television in any market. And when it's full, it's full. It's not the same as that anyone could buy a photocopier and print their own newsletter.
It's an American media landscape prior to cable television and prior to the internet.
Yeah, something probably hard for people today to understand that we're talking about a time when you're talking about broadcast only, meaning AM, FM, and over-the-air television.
Right. And the court says this so specifically that 4 years later in 1973, they have almost an identical case come up where someone wants a right of reply. But in this case, it's in a Florida newspaper. And the Supreme Court says, no, it's a newspaper, right? The same rules don't apply.
Get your own
now, the precedent from Red Lion should have directly influenced that case. Tornillo is the name of that case. But because the court sees broadcasting and newspapers as so fundamentally different at the time, it upholds it. It does say one really important thing in Red Lion that I think doesn't get spoken about enough anymore. It says this is true right now in 1969. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be true down the road. Huh. And if this comes back up, we might need to revisit this. Now, the FCC and the Supreme Court have never revisited this. The Supreme Court, as it stands, Red Lion is still good law. The Fairness Doctrine, however, is not.
Is it crazy to ask why they knew that the media landscape would change so much? Is it because they had seen television come forward so quickly as a primary medium that they knew something else in the future was coming? Or is that distraction.
There were already perfunctionatory citizen access television station and cable providers by 1969. I mean, the earliest cable systems from the mid-50s. So, I mean, they knew it was changing, but I think their point was is that broadcasting is this really kind of unique situation, right? That we let them regulate indecency. The focus, of course, is not on whether or not the broadcasters have the right to be protected from the government. The focus is on making sure that citizens have access to information, and as wide a possible information, given the structure of the broadcasting industry. So Red Lion upholds the broadcasting, the FCC's implementation of the Fairness Doctrine and the political, editorial, and personal attack rules. And it'll be the 1980s when things get really interesting for the Fairness Doctrine.
Yeah, so we are talking about the Fairness Doctrine here on Radio Survivor. We're talking with Professor Christopher Terry from the University of Minnesota. I'm Paul Rees-Mandel. Of course, also joining me is Jennifer Waits and Eric Klein. And Chris, you know, I wanted to back up a little bit right? Because so the, you know, the rule that we're kind of looking at that was added to the Fairness Doctrine in 1967, right? This personal attack rule, which is I think what a lot of people, you know, have in their mind to some extent, you know, that was added in 1967. Like, do you have a sense, like, why was this rule added? What is it about the political landscape that caught, because it was added by the FCC, correct? This was not a congressional action. This was a regulatory action.
Right.
So what was going on there? This would have been still the Johnson administration, correct? So with a Democratic administration, a Democratic FCC, at a fairly tumultuous time in our nation's history. Why is this rule added then?
Well, part of the reason is that the broadcasters wanted to understand when they had to let somebody else talk, right? The political editorial and personal attack rules, the reason that they're not separate rules and the reason that they're always associated with the Fairness Doctrine is they're really just qualifications of the Fairness Doctrine. Now, part of the story, of course, is what happens after Newton Meinow gives his vast wasteland speech, right? Broadcasters start to stand up and say, you know what, we're kind of afraid of these regulators. And they start asking the regulators to say what it is that they actually want. And it's basically the same question the broadcasters were asking of the FCC 30 years before that, at the time of the Blue Book and the Mayflower decision. They're like, okay, well, if you want us to do these things, you can't tell us this, you know, sort of without some structure. We need structure. And the real intent of the political editorial and personal attack rules was to provide that structure to the Fairness Doctrine's application.
Got it. You know, it's interesting to me, you know, it's a little bit of like, be careful what you ask for, right? You know, that I think has been this push-pull, I mean, certainly between broadcasters and the Federal Communications Commission for a very long time. And I don't want to take us too far off the path, but I can't help but think of indecency regulation, right? Which you know, many people are familiar with. It's the fact that, in all intents and purposes, indecent programming shouldn't be aired between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. on broadcast radio and television. The FCC is the body that regulates that speech on radio or television. And for the longest time, and by the longest time I say, at least since 1978, the FCC has never given a specific doctrine of what is or is not permissible. And it's been this sort of dance we've watched back and forth between broadcasters and the commission because of the fact that it's, you know, as much as it's often thought of as the seven dirty words,
which was invented by a comedian. Yeah.
Which is only because of the George Carlin skit, which prompted ultimately a Supreme Court review.
To this day, I won't say the P words into this microphone, even right. though they're probably okay.
But yeah, it's same not the thing. Yeah,
but it's not the fact that those seven words are actually in any rule written down anywhere that you definitively can't say them during normal, daytime hours.
And at college radio conferences that I go to where you get to chat and ask questions of lawyers, that's some of the most lively those are the questions that get asked the most is student broadcasters and advisors asking what can and can't we say as far as indecency and obscenity on the air. It's so confusing to people.
It's not actually that confusing. The FCC does not have active rules other than the egregious situation standard. It's actually not true that the FCC didn't have standards for indecency. They've just never been consistent. They've changed several times.
And they're not really published.
Actually, that's not true either. Published in 1987, 2001, 2006, and then again in 2013.
Different show. Fairness.
Yeah, I guess. Right. Well, yeah, no, that's fine. And I think, you know, I guess, though, that you know, being published, I think, though, the sense from broadcasters has always been, certainly non-commercial broadcasters, I can speak more to than commercial broadcasters, has been all of that guidance was all still very vague. All still, you know, not really answering that question of
a non-regulatory FCC say it isn't so.
Yeah, can't say this word, can't, you know, can't describe this activity beyond a certain point. you know, it's all still very vague. And it's often, especially when you talk with non-commercial broadcasters, it's very much reading the tea leaves or working off of cases of fines where the circumstance is 25, 30 years old. So anyway, I just bring that up because I think it's interesting that this case of the Fairness Doctrine, you know, having been elaborated, you know, with these additional rules, you know, comes from the broadcasters themselves sort of asking for clarity here in 1967.
I think it might be worth mentioning that there are rare occasions that we know that radio stations, very rare, but rare occasions where radio stations were punished for indecency.
And it stings and people remember it, yes.
But has there ever been a Fairness Doctrine stick used in the last 100 years?
Well, that's what Red Lion was. I mean, that was the decision, is that Red Lion said that.
So
the
when I said Fairness Doctrine there, unfortunately, I meant the myth of the Fairness Doctrine, the myth that everyone, that there should be two sides to every political controversy on the airwaves, and the Fairness Doctrine is what governs that.
Well, of course, the real myth of the Fairness Doctrine is that Kenny can come back.
Right.
Starting in the 1980s, under the Fowler FCC, the FCC started to roll back all kinds of content regulation, including the Fairness Doctrine. The key moment, of course, was in 1985 when the FCC released its report, funded almost entirely by the NEB,
the National Association of Broadcasters,
that said that the Fairness Doctrine was actually impeding the discussion of public issues because stations were too afraid of the stick, to use Eric's word, and they didn't want to cover controversial public issues because they were afraid they would do that. And Fowler's FCC argued if we just got rid of this rule, there would be this Shangri-La of new opinion and new coverage and new discussion. Of course, it didn't work. Correspondingly, in time to that, there are three cases that come up in the D.C. Circuit that deal with Fairness Doctrine complaints. Two of them, Meredith and Syracuse, are about advertising, pro-nuclear power advertising that people want to have the ability to respond to. The other case is about teletext and whether or not teletext is subject to Fairness Doctrine standards, because teletext sends a signal in the bottom of the wave and in the gaps between the waves. And
it's encoded in television, yeah.
We don't need to go there. Okay, but anyway, what ends up happening is the FCC begins to argue against the Fairness Doctrine and they stop enforcing it in the mid-80s. In 1987, the Syracuse decision comes up, and the D.C. Circuit Court says to the FCC, look, if you don't like this rule, stop enforcing it. You have that authority. So the FCC stops enforcing it. 1987 is when that happens, okay? But the story isn't over there. The Fairness Doctrine is still on the books in sort of this kind of weird, superfluous way. It's not being enforced by the FCC. It hasn't been enforced for almost a decade at that point. But it's still on the books. The next big moment, of course, is in 2000. There's a challenge under the political editorial rule between the Bush campaign and the Gore campaign. And it goes to the D.C. Circuit, and the rule is still on the books, right? You're still supposed to provide this transcript and all these things that the political editorial required. And the D.C. Circuit says to the FCC, okay, we're not really sure that this rule actually exists anymore. We're really not sure if this rule works anymore. So we're going to give you 30 days to defend the rule if you want it to stay on the books. Of course, the FCC just let that slide, and the political editorial and personal attack rules died. But that is actually not the end of the story. When Obama is elected president, suddenly the Fairness Doctrine crawled out of a tomb like a zombie, and people started talking about it again. Now, I had been in broadcast. This is when I was working for Clear Channel. I had been in broadcasting for more than a decade at that point. And I just remember being shocked that anyone was still talking about it, like that even there were people at the station that I worked with who weren't even old enough to remember what the Fairness Doctrine was. Right. And what happens is it sort of becomes a boogeyman. So the final death of the Fairness Doctrine is not during the Fowler era. It's actually in 2011. Congress actually formally repeals the FCC's authority to enforce the Fairness Doctrine, and it's gone. But that is also not the end of the story. There is one last gasp of air for the Fairness Doctrine. In 2014, Sue Wilson files a Zapple Doctrine complaint. The Zapple Doctrine was a Fairness Doctrine interpretation dealing with competing supporters of, but not actually officially spokesperson for, political campaigns. It applied in only one case. Sue Wilson tried to make a complaint about Milwaukee radio stations not giving sort of fair shakes to supporters of the Democrats that were running a gubernatorial candidate against Scott Walker in the state of Wisconsin. That was Tom Barrett at the time. And she tried to bring a Zapple complaint. She actually cited the Zapple complaint in her filings in the media ownership proceeding that happened this week. But that said, the FCC was like, we don't really have any authority to enforce this thing anymore. And they denied that. So it died its last gasping breath. Like we put the machete through the head of the zombie in 2014. But now it's back again. Right? Here we are talking about it again.
It can't come back. Why are people calling you and asking you about the Fairness Doctrine? Who wants to bring it back and in what context?
Well, there's people who want to apply a Fairness Doctrine-like rule to social media postings. That's one thing. But there's a lot of people who object to...
Can we just name it? That's like a Florida governor Republican culture war thing. I'll just say
there's
that. I'm
going to say it. We could spend an entire show talking about Section 230 issues on that. But the other thing is that a lot of people object to what's on cable news. Right. They think that if somehow magically the FCC were to reinstate the Fairness Doctrine, Fox News and even some people who object to MSNBC's content would be forced to be forced to give the other side. That, of course, isn't true even when the Fairness Doctrine was in place, because those are cable stations. But that this sort of concern about misinformation, that really wasn't what the Fairness Doctrine ever dealt with. The Fairness Doctrine was designed to stimulate discussion of issues in a local market. That was what its intent was. And this idea that it would somehow balance these discussions is just misplaced. I don't know why it comes back every once in a while. The confusion with the equal time rule is not a new thing. That goes way back. But it is back, and people are talking about it again. And that's part of the reason why I thought it was great that we decided to talk about this today, is because I wanted to kind of set the record straight. It's not coming back. Absent an act of Congress giving the FCC the official authority to do something about it, it can't come back. And that's simply not going
to
happen.
And it can be, it could be politically useful to have a boogeyman. And the FCC is a wonderful boogeyman. Most federal agencies are great boogeymen because of the fact that they are unelected formally, even if they are appointed, politically. And, seem opaque. They seem vague, as we sort of talked before. And, as a result, it's easy to sort of imply upon them or project upon them that they are definitely kind of in the background, ready to pounce and seize control.
Yeah, and I would include that it's a very potent myth that things worked better in the past before I was born or when I was younger. And the way I understand the Fairness Doctrine myth is that it was okay. It worked until Reagan broke it, which is a very potent way to worry about the political world. That Reaganism was kind of the Rubicon that we crossed, and that the media never recovered.
Yeah.
The fair and balanced media never recovered from the Reagan years. Is kind of where it comes from.
Well, I mean, that's part of the legend of the Fairness Doctrine, right? Is that somehow the growth of Rush Limbaugh and other talk formats at the time, at the time you start to see early rounds of consolidation and ownership, you start to see more nationalized content. And frankly, that was, for a lot of people, that was a fairly bleak time in American history. It's easy to point the finger at that time. But the thing that I love to point out to people now is, even if the Fairness Doctrine worked in the sort of mythical Dungeons and Dragons format that people imagine it in, there's no way you'd want the FCC to be in charge of enforcing it. A, the FCC lacks anything meaningful in the term of resources to be actually able to adjudicate these complaints in any sort of meaningful time. But you want, you don't, do you really want a government regulator to be making decisions on what speech is allowed and not allowed? I, as a First Amendment scholar, I find that quite difficult to swallow.
One that is controlled by the executive branch.
Well, that's, I mean, you make the exact point, Eric, is that when you're talking about this, that's what you're talking about. But remember, these ideas are not, I mean, they're not just from crackpots on the web. Commissioner Carr has actively been seeking the ability to sort of compel speech in social media for over a year. The NTIA's petition for the FCC to revisit what Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act does, and we've talked about that on the show before, is that, I mean, he actually would like to have that compelled speech. Now, he would never call it the Fairness Doctrine, but what he's asking for, and he's not alone, Ted Cruz has asked for this in Congress. A number of Democrats have asked for it in Congress, right? There's a sort of this mainstream myth about how we could do this without actually calling it the Fairness Doctrine.
Well, you know, so Chris, I mean, you know, speaking very specifically about radio, I mean, you brought up just a moment ago the Rush Limbaugh example, right? Which was coincident with, you know, the rise of Rush Limbaugh in the mid-1990s is coincident with the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which lifted any caps on national radio station ownership, right? You know, and sort of, it's a perfect storm in a sort of a political economic sort of way, because it Rush Limbaugh's programming also was very cheap for these newly founded large radio companies like the former Clear Channel to put on AM radio stations all over the country, and also, you know, proved to be relatively popular and profitable as a result. And in a lot of minds, I think, of many people who consider themselves to be liberal or left, they think, but if, you know, much of what, you know, sort of the Rush Limbaugh style programming is a lot of attacks, really, honestly. It's a lot of personal attack, you know. So even putting aside just simply espousing a conservative viewpoint, which is sort of one part of where the Fairness Doctrine might apply, where it's a little more vague, as you've noted, that the station that airing a Rush Limbaugh should also make some effort to provide some other views on the air. But it really would be Rush Limbaugh's personal attacks against people, both often who are more politicians, you know. So, you know, Bill Clinton, who President Clinton at the time. But he was also well known for going after people who were private citizens, more or less, kind of thrust into the news because of often reasons beyond their control. And I think often, you know, folks feel like, well, at the very least, a Fairness Doctrine, especially that personal attack rule, that would have provided some curtailment. You know, is that correct? Can you pick that apart for me?
Sure. There's a little debate on that point, but there's an important word in the discussion of Rush Limbaugh that gets lost a lot. It actually gets lost in a lot of FCC discussions, and that's the word local. Remember, what the Fairness Doctrine required was discussion of local public issues, right? And there's an argument to be made that Limbaugh's show doesn't talk about very many local issues, right? That it's a national show. And remember, the Fairness Doctrine was still on the books when Rush Limbaugh was getting started. And for most of the time that Rush Limbaugh was doing the things that he was doing, up to and including the 2000 election, the FCC was still still had on the books the personal attack and political editorial rules. When I was at WISN in Milwaukee, I started shortly after there was a personal attack case involving one of our local hosts against a college professor at UW-Milwaukee. His name was Dave Berkman, sort of a controversial figure in Milwaukee. But he, you know, there was actually, I mean, these cases were still being adjudicated, but by the point that Limbaugh was sort of hitting his stride, the FCC wasn't enforcing these rules quite as stringently as it may have done in some imaginary time before that. You used the indecency example before. Remember that since 1934 till today, There are less than 120 fines issued for indecency by the FCC in American history. And it's substantially less than 120, but it depends on how you count. Right? So for you, think about all the rigmarole that surrounded indecency. The same enforcement, you know, that you think about back to 2004 and the Super Bowl and Howard Stern and Bubba the Love Sponge and all these other high-profile radio people. Anthony, Opie and Anthony, right? You know, they had their couple of cases that were there. They had the Ron Jeremy case. They had the Jerry Garcia case way back in the 70s, right? All of these cases combined added up to less than 120 cases. Mm-hmm. Of indecency enforcement. Now, indecency, you can't listen to a broadcast radio station and not hear something that would have qualified as indecency at one point or another. I mean, it's right. Just part and parcel of how we speak. But that doesn't mean it's enforceable, right? And it doesn't mean the FCC has the resources to enforce it. It's no different on the political speech side. And in fact, touching the political speech rail puts the FCC into a really uncomfortable position where they've got to adjudicate these, as you talk, personal attack disputes. That's just something the FCC really doesn't want to do. But even if it did, the process the FCC has to go through to adjudicate a complaint like this takes a very long time. And even if the FCC ultimately agreed with me, so to use your Limbaugh example, Limbaugh had some very choice words to say about me at one point. He actually talked about me on air by name. Okay.
Congratulations.
Well, it was a few years back now. But the point is that by the time if I had taken issue with that and I had tried to get the FCC to do something about it, the rules were gone by then. But just to play it out, it would have been months before I could have possibly won a case. Well, by then, nobody's going to even remember that Limbaugh talked about. We talked about a 2-minute segment on one day, right? Was I unhappy about it? I thought it was kind of funny at the time, actually. But that's... the point is still the same, right? Even if I had recourse to go after him under the personal attack rule, by the time I would have that, it wouldn't matter, right? The damage, so much as it is, would be done.
Christopher and, Terry, why was Rush Limbaugh peeved at you? I mean, we have to know.
In 2014, I gave an interview to the New Republic magazine talking about the Milwaukee talk radio scene. And my larger point in the article, or the larger point of the interview, was that Scott Walker had, as governor, had very friendly media in town, and that he was very friendly on sort of a personal first name basis with many of the talk radio people here in Milwaukee. And that when he met a more critical media and down the road, that was going to go bad. That was put into the context of a larger article that sort of turned me into persona non grata, and, you know, I lost my Clear Channel consulting gig as a result of it. But that, you know, those details, right? That's a long time ago.
Wow, Wisconsin culture war.
Yeah,
trenches.
Well, anyway. But the point is still the same, right? There is no, even if the Fairness Doctrine had ever existed the way people imagine it to, there's no way the FCC could enforce it in a meaningful way. Yeah. I don't necessarily disagree with the idea that balance is a bad thing, right? More viewpoints is something I've spent 25 years advocating for, both as a broadcaster, but also as a scholar. You know, I think ownership issues are tied to diversity, and I think that those are really important issues. But that doesn't mean I also think that the FCC should be in a position to be adjudicating these disputes between individuals over things that were said about them, and then in turn compelling a platform, social media platform, for example, to say that. I mean, you can't believe in the First Amendment and agree with that. The greatest legacy of the First Amendment and the greatest legacy of the First Amendment's application to the Fairness Doctrine is the idea that media is supposed to serve the public. What is really compelling about the Red Lion decision is not that it upheld the Fairness Doctrine. That's sort of the historical part of that story. What's really interesting is that the court took this point of view that because broadcasting is such a scarce resource, that there's only so many stations in a spot, there's only so much information that can move past that, that the people that matter in that arrangement are the listeners and the audience. That is the thing that people should take away from Red Lion. Because that is exactly the type of issue that we talk about when we talk about net neutrality, right? What can citizens have access to, right? It's very much the same issue for the next generation telecommunications. But beyond that, Red Lion isn't really that interesting of a decision. It's a fairly technical decision. It really doesn't employ very much traditional First Amendment theory. And most importantly, it's basically, although it's never been overturned, it's basically irrelevant because there is no fairness doctrine to come back. And even if it did, it wouldn't do what people assume it did. It'd be neat if it ever had done that. It never would have worked, but it would have been neat anyway.
You know, right. And what I think always is that, you know, part of it, and I think we've been circling this, right, is really what changed in this time period, that, you know, to this imagined past which didn't really exist of fairness, you know, and, you know, in the media and balance in the media. But what changed fundamentally is the entire economic structure in a lot of ways. It's not fundamentally overturned, but the consolidation certainly radically changed both radio and television. And, you know, and now that, because in 94, you know, cable and broadcast were mostly separate industries, right? You know, and now they, of course, are utterly, you know, Comcast, NBC being the strongest example, you know, they are all one and the same. You know, and that fundamentally kind of changes the incentives. It changes how everything is produced. It changes how things are distributed. And, you know, I think in some ways that's sort of what maybe people are often reacting to. And yet that seems like it's not just the horses out of the barn. You know, it's every horse is out of all of the barns everywhere.
Well, remember that the Fairness Doctrine was designed to apply to situations where a local broadcaster did something to a local individual, right? In 1949, they never envisioned the kind of media structure or the media content production structure that we have. And today, I mean, they just, it's beyond scale in what they could have even possibly would have been. It wouldn't even have been science fiction. It would have been science fiction about science fiction. Right. So in that situation, the Fairness Doctrine makes sense, right? Station covers a public issue. It's an important public issue. They give an opinion on it, right? And then other people in that community might want to have the ability to give another opinion on it. That makes sense. And it can be applied at that level. And again, the station had the authority to decide who got to speak on those things. Mm-hmm. That would have been doable. But this national production structure, these syndicated programs, you know, to say nothing of cable and how its content is produced and distributed, you couldn't take what the Fairness Doctrine was designed to do, which was cover these local public issues with more than one point of view, and apply it on the top of that model. It can't work. It wouldn't work, and it was never meant to work that way.
It's so funny because it just appears to me, based on today's conversation where I've learned so much, that the myth of the Fairness Doctrine might not exist if they hadn't named it so well. It's like, don't we all wish there really was a fair, neat, you know, just fairness? Like, can't we all, like, just go back and agree that fairness is a quality that we all want to see again in the world?
And Chris, you pointed out that, you know, in some ways, you know, if we're going to use that word fairness, you know, and it's something we've talked to you before, fairness might be more in the direction of more diverse ownership, greater presence of women and minorities in the ownership and direction of mass media, but in the particular case of the FCC, of broadcast media, where more or less that share has been in decline, rather than an ascendancy. One might say
as well as local control,
kind of fairness.
As well as local control, like women and and minority ownership as well as local ownership of broadcast media.
Well, it's not local ownership. It's local operation that matters. The idea that you can syndicate programming and ship it off to seven places and have it be the same is different than producing content for each individual station. And it's operation that matters. Ownership and operation are obviously closely related. The more stations you have, the more likely you are to centralize your production model. But the reality is that if stations are operated locally, which many stations owned by women and minorities, especially Hispanics, are actually operated in the markets in which they are based, that changes the dynamic substantially.
Right, because whether, I mean, certainly, going back to Rush Limbaugh, because he's a sort of a great foil for this, very early in his syndication career, he was syndicated to locally owned stations, right, and locally owned clusters, especially, 1994, when he was, an ascendancy in terms of his overall cultural influence. It wasn't via enormous chains of co-owned stations. It was actually, often mom and pop operations.
Yeah. Yes, mom and pop, one and two outstation operations. When I was in broadcasting school in the early 90s, he was on a singly owned commercial station in Oshkosh, Wisconsin for a while, right? Just one AM out there by itself in the middle of a field somewhere.
Because it was cheap, I'm sure.
So, Christopher, we have to ask you, other than advising public intellectuals and reporters not to use the Fairness Doctrine as a bygone example of where things went wrong, what other advice do you have for the people of letters in this world who have Fairness Doctrine on their minds?
Forget that it existed other than as a historical archive of broadcast regulation. It's gone. It's not coming back. And you would do better if you care about misinformation and cable programming to advocate for a la carte cable packaging, which takes away the subsidy, which is given to channels like Fox and MSNBC through your cable subscription rate. If you really want to do something about Fox News, and I've advocated this for years, a la carte cable, where you pick and choose exactly what stations you get, is a far more aggressive regulatory solution than the Fairness Doctrine ever could have been.
And one that's so incredibly multi-partisan, I can't believe it. Everybody can get behind the idea that I only want to pay for the cable stations I want. It seems very, that might be the most popular regulatory proposal I have ever heard. I only want to pay for what I want to pay for. That's an American dream. Dr. Christopher Terry, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Survivor.
Always great to be here. I love being met.
Christopher Terry is assistant professor, journalism and mass communication at the University of Minnesota. He joins us often on Radio Survivor to talk about media law. And today, we really unwound the myths behind the Fairness Doctrine. If you'd like to hear a longer version of this episode or re-listen, you can find us online at radiosurvivor.com or subscribe to the podcast, Radio Survivor. Our email address is podcast@radiosurvivor.com. On behalf of Jennifer Waits and Paul Reese-Mendel, my name is Eric Klein. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.